Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Bogan. Welcome to the Q&A portion of this CME Outfitters webcast. You can send me your questions and comments in the question box on your screen or via email at questions@cmeoutfitters.com or via Twitter using the hashtag #SleepCME. I look forward to hearing from you. We have received some questions already, so let's get started. The first question we have is, do you manage patients with stimulants plus sodium oxybate? And certainly we do. Sodium oxybate, as you know, is approved by the FDA to treat excessive sleepiness. It's also approved to treat cataplexy. But in the clinical trials, particularly the cataplexy trials, 80% of the patients were on stimulants. And clinically, probably that's correct. I think in my practice, at least 80% of patients are on some sort of stimulant along with the sodium oxybate. We do have some patients who respond to sodium oxybate alone and do not take stimulants or don't tolerate stimulants because of anxiety or cardiovascular side effects. So we do have some individuals on monotherapy, but certainly combination therapy is appropriate. Is there any data on the long-term effect of sodium oxybate? In the clinical trials, we had an open-label extension trial that where patients were allowed to have their dosage adjusted, and the duration of therapy was as long as 52 months. So those patients were followed both from a safety and efficacy perspective, again, open label, and allowing dose to effect. But in that clinical trial, the patients continued to have well over 90% response to their cataplexy and probably in the neighborhood of high 70% response in terms of the excessive daytime sleepiness. But that's the main data that we have and from that particular perspective. Here's another question on, didn't discuss the impact of family on outcomes for patients. You know, when we talked about clinical global impression, and when we interview our patients, we use objective measures such as the Epworth score, but we also ask patients, how does the excessive sleepiness affect your work performance, your social performance, your family performance, driving performance, and also it's very useful to have family members, or I call them reliable witnesses, to tell us about how the individual is functioning, because sometimes these individuals don't know. The peak incidence of excessive sleepiness and narcolepsy is in the teenage years, so they kind of grow up being sleepy and they don't really have a good point of reference other than a therapeutic response. So I think it is useful to get objective opinions about how the patient's performing, but also the impact on family interaction is extremely useful. We talked about, there's a question here about the onset of action of sodium oxybate, and this particular clinician notes that there may be some efficacy issues early on, the patients get frustrated. And I think that's very important from an educational perspective. Because based on the study designs and the PI for sodium oxybate, we typically initiate therapy at 4.5 grams. Of course, it's in divided doses. It has a short half-life being metabolized through the Krebs cycle to carbon dioxide and water. So the half-life is very short. It's about an hour, plus or minus. So they take half the dose in the bed, prepared to go to bed, and they take the second dose 2.5 to 4 hours later. That was the study design, and that's been translated into the PI. I tell patients that we're starting at this dose. That's the way we do it, and ask if they have any side effects, again, headache, dizzy, nausea, or sedation are the side effects we look for. And then let me know within 1 week how they're doing. I usually tell them this dose is not going to be effective. It's not like taking an amphetamine and feeling it within an hour. It doesn't do that. And they also don't understand necessarily why they're taking a medicine at night that's treating excessive sleepiness and cataplexy the next day. So it takes a lot of education. Have the patient check back in a week, and if they're not having any side effects, I go right on to the 6-gram dose. In the long-term open-label trial, probably close to 80% of patients were on doses of 6 grams, 7.5, and 9 grams, almost evenly divided. So again, we dose to effect, encourage the patient that it may take as long as 2 months to reach the optimal effect. And I think if we preface our initiation of therapy with that, patients are going to be much more tolerant. And you know, if they get a response, it's going to, it can be a significant, dramatic response in terms of their therapeutic issue. Question here. Daughter with years of hypersomnia, excessive sleepiness with negative impact on academics, fragmented sleep at times, managed for 3 years on methylphenidate and Nuvigil, and then Nuvigil during the day, no cataplexy, can nap for hours and has a diagnosis of narcolepsy type 2, and delayed sleep phase is also an issue. Yeah, this is very common because, as we know, when you hit puberty, there is this tendency to have a circadian shift to delaying sleep. And narcolepsy patients still have a circadian rhythm. And sometimes the narcolepsy folks will tell you that their best time is late at night, right before they get sleepy. And for a couple of reasons, they've been napping some during the day. And as we said, narcolepsy folks are good nappers. They can take a short nap, a 15 or 20 minute nap, and feel somewhat restored. Now, it's not sustainable. So it's almost like narcolepsy patients oscillate back and forth between wake and sleep and wake and sleep. They can have fragmented sleep, and we've actually had some patients present as insomnia because they're aware of the awakening. My classic patient is, I've shared this with others before, is the patient who says, "Doc, I never sleep. I dream all night," because they have these very vivid dreams and sleep paralysis. They may even actually have REM behavior disorder. If you talk to a bed partner of someone who has narcolepsy, they may yell or scream or talk or kick, jerk at night, because they may actually have REM behavior disorder as well as sleep paralysis, and of course the hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations. So their sleep is really not normal sleep. Now, we do have patients with primary hypersomnia, and now there's a lot of interest in this spectrum of individuals who are long sleepers, or who, when they take a nap, they take a long nap, and then they have a lot of sleep inertia. When we see that, we begin to question, is this really primary hypersomnia versus type 2 narcolepsy, or is it delayed sleep phase and insufficient sleep? One of the differentiating factors is in delayed sleep phase, those individuals, when they're given an opportunity to get adequate sleep, they function all right. So if you say in the summertime when you were able to go to bed at 2 a.m. and sleep till 10, how did you do? And they weren't sleepy. They were able to entrain in their biological rhythm and didn't have excessive sleepiness. That's always a clue. Of course, actigraphy sometimes is beneficial in these individuals to make sure they're getting an adequate quantity of sleep. So this whole area of delayed sleep phase, primary hypersomnia, type 2 narcolepsy sometimes can be very confusing. And of course, a sleepy individual is going to have problems with cognition, attention, response time, short-term memory, even mood. We know patients with narcolepsy have problems with sometimes with their performance, reaction times, and other issues. Can we talk about recognition and treatment in young adults? I think we sort of just covered that. Oftentimes, they are misdiagnosed because teenagers are sleepy people. They stay up late and they sleep in, and the challenge of recognizing delayed sleep phase and primary hypersomnia and type 2 narcolepsy, it makes it difficult. I think that's one reason the delay in diagnosis has been 10 years, and in the past 15 years, because these people grew up this way and they didn't know they had a problem until they reached young adulthood and it persists, and then they recognize. Now, patients who have severe cataplexy, type 1 narcolepsy, or profound daytime sleepiness, they bubble to the top, and we see those more quickly. But I would say probably 50% of our patients with narcolepsy have not really been diagnosed at this time, which is remarkable when you think about these individuals with profound sleepiness and these REM dissociative events, that we have problems recognizing these individuals. Next question, can you comment on the incidence of depression in these patients, and is there underlying neurobiological link? Well, we don't understand the neurobiological link. We do know that particularly in type 1 narcolepsy, there's a hypercretin signaling problem. These individuals have low CSF hypercretin, presumptively due to an autoimmune abnormality. So they get the flu or strep throat or something, and they fight the infection, but then it cross-reacts with hypocretin neurons in the hypothalamus. So these individuals have low hypocretin levels, and that actually has been incorporated into the ICSD-3. And then, you know, they typically have cataplexy as well. Those individuals, we know hypocretin signaling is abnormal. Hypocretin is an important neurotransmitter for stabilizing state of wakefulness. It has downstream effects on norepinephrine and dopamine and activates the brain. So we don't know how that links to our depression, but what we do know is that when you follow individuals with narcolepsy, the prevalence of mood disturbance, anxiety, and depression is fairly high. It's north of 30%, so maybe 30 to 40% of patients. And so it's important for us to follow these individuals and address that whenever appropriate. Outside of cataplexy, in the context of genetic narcolepsy, in what other conditions have you seen cataplexy or pseudo-cataplexy? And what is the pathophysiologic basis for cataplexy being induced by emotional stimuli or startle? Well, we don't know exactly what causes cataplexy. We do know that because of the hypocretin deficient state, the pontine rim generator, which is a cholinergic receptor, is overactive. And when you are asleep at night and you begin to wash out catecholamines, dopamine, hypocretin levels drop, the rim generator becomes active. And so typically in most individuals, it's going to be somewhere north of 60 minutes, maybe even 90 minutes, before you get into a REM episode. So the pontine area activates, it has fibers that go up to the thalamus and then to the cortex, so it activates the cortex, we dream. And of course, there's downward inhibition of the motor control neurons, so we're paralyzed. And so the brain is active, yet the body's paralyzed, the brain looks like it's awake, so we call it paradoxical sleep. In narcolepsy, because of this hypocretin deficient state, the REM generator is overactive and pops in there. And in the daytime, if the pontine generator turns on and inhibits motor activity, the thalamocortical fibers are already active, so the brain's awake. So mainly it's the motor paralysis. There's some theories about, you know, amygdala connection to this area where strong emotion may trigger or activate these pontine neurons and contributes to the motor paralysis, but those circuits are not very well known in terms of what actually happens. It's really more observational and speculation about what's going on. But what we've done is we've translated, you know, I spoke earlier about the anticholinergic may actually inhibit the REM on cells, or our serotonergic or norepinephrine drugs may activate the REM off cells, and which would in turn inhibit the REM on cells. So in the past, before we had sodium oxybate, those were drugs that we commonly used. Of course, we can, anytime you have patients with major mood disturbance and some other things, we can see conversion reactions, and some individuals that may, much like you have hysterical reactions with epilepsy, you could have a pseudo-cataplexy state. If you get a chance to witness an episode of cataplexy, these individuals are areflexic during this time. They have inhibition of motor activity, so that can be a differentiating factor. And I've actually seen that in my clinic before, where we had a patient had what looked like to be a cataplectic episode, but they were hyperreflexic, so they were hyperventilating, more hysterical. We had the polling question results. Thought we'd go over that. Please give the you know, we'll look at those. It's interesting. If you look at the polling results about what do you think in terms of initiating therapy within 1 month, and if you look at our data, probably the majority of them actually was 1 to 25%. 25 to 50, 14%. 50 to 75%, only 4%. And 75 to 100% initiate therapy with 11%. So it's really all over the place, but the highest was in the 1 to 25. I think that's a process issue that we all can address. I mean, it's, sometimes medicine takes a while, but certainly we want to be keen in these individuals when we recognize excessive sleepiness and we make the diagnosis to initiate therapy. The next question is, how do treatments like stimulants, modafinil, and sodium oxybate impact sleep architecture? Excellent question. what we know is that armodafinil, the data in the narcolepsy trials, sleep studies were done and had no effect on sleep architecture. There was no change in sleep stage distribution, total sleep time, sleep efficiency with modafinil, armodafinil. With the stimulants, we have limited data. And obviously, if you take the stimulants too late, we can have prolonged sleep latency, but not any definitive change in sleep architecture that I know of. So not a lot of data on that. Sodium oxybate, that's been published from the pivotal trial data. Sleep studies were done. And what we do know is sodium oxybate is a GABA-B agonist, so it inhibits the dopamine and norepinephrine circuits, so it does make you sleepy. And what we saw in the clinical trials was that sleep latency decreased, slow wave sleep increased, as was the major thing, and then there were a decrease in number of awakenings, sleep efficiency increased. So the main thing in sodium oxybate is an increase in slow wave sleep. Now, it's how does that translate into the therapeutic effect the next day is a puzzle. We don't really know. We're not treating the sleep. We're treating the excessive sleepiness. We're treating the cataplexy. And here's a short-acting drug. It has a half-life, you know, of an hour plus, gone in 4 to 6 hours, certainly, usually within 4 hours, and yet it has this residual next-day effect. We don't really know exactly why. And the effect can be enduring. So some patients, for example, if they're going to have surgery and we stop the sodium oxybate, we usually don't wean it. We just stop it. It's interesting, the cataplexy doesn't come back immediately, and actually there was a long-term clinical trial looking at that. Those patients, long-term trial, when we stopped the sodium oxybate, it took a couple of weeks for the cataplexy to begin to come back to baseline. We don't really fully understand that, but it's very interesting molecule. Next question, do patients with narcolepsy need regular reassessment in the sleep lab? And are there quality or reimbursement issues? That's not part of the standard of care to repeat sleep studies in individuals. Once you've made the diagnosis of narcolepsy and you're sure that's what the diagnosis is based on ICSD-3 criteria, technically, it doesn't go away. There may be some rare cases where someone had some inflammation or something in an area of hypocretin control, and for some reason that resolved, but that's usually not the case. So if you made the diagnosis, no need to repeat. However, this is a chronic disorder, and patients develop other sleep disorders. So patients with narcolepsy are more obese. They have higher risk of developing sleep apnea, and they also have more periodic leg movements. So if you as a clinician think, as you follow the patient, that something is going on, have they developed sleep apnea, for example? We know in narcolepsy the prevalence of sleep apnea is somewhere between 20 and 25%. They're more at risk. So it is important to follow them and repeat a study, primarily an apnea protocol, if you think that they are at risk. And usually there's no particular reimbursement if it's ordered for that kind of study. Is there a high incidence of comorbid ADHD in these adolescent patients, or is it just a side effect or lack of sleep? This is really an interesting question. I would say one of my biggest referrers to my clinic for narcolepsy is actually a patient of mine who is a physician who does some attention deficit disorder work, and he identifies a lot of people who are sleepy, and he sends them over, and it ends up that it's their sleepiness that's causing the inattention. And some people get hyperactive when they're sleepy, particularly children. So we do realize that there may be an error in diagnosis in some of these individuals because sleepiness does affect executive function, including attention and short-term memory and focus and reaction times. So there is some executive function abnormality associated with excessive sleepiness, which may be mistaken. There was a publication not too long ago, I can't remember the exact reference, that did look at the presence of attention deficit problems in narcolepsy patients, and some of them do actually have attention deficit problems as well, which can be difficult to assess, and it's almost like having comorbid insomnia with depression. I mean, which is the yin and the yang there? So But there is a, and according to this publication, there is a slight increase in the prevalence of attention deficit problems. So something to consider. Only board-certified sleep specialists can initiate sodium oxybate therapy. That is not correct. There is a REMS program, a risk evaluation mitigation strategy, and the REMS program is there's a central pharmacy that is basically dispenses the drug. The central pharmacy is charged with making sure the patient knows the drug, how to dose it, take it correctly. The physicians actually go through a brief REMS program to make sure they know the molecule and dosing and how to follow the patients. And the patients go through this as well. But theoretically, any physician who can appropriately make the diagnosis based on the standard of care can prescribe the medication. Next question. I have a patient with narcolepsy, and I manage him for his heart failure and wonder if I need to be concerned about sleep-inducing treatments. Do you have a recommendation? You know, comorbid cardiovascular disease and narcolepsy is a concern because the typical stimulants that we use, the amphetamines and methylphenidate, do increase autonomic tone. And many of those patients may be on a beta blocker, a peripheral beta blocker, which could be protective. And I always check with the cardiologist to make sure he agrees what medicines and what dose I can use because of this effect on autonomic tone that can increase heart rate and blood pressure, particularly the amphetamine, methylphenidate. We see that less with armodafinil and modafinil patients. So, of course, sodium oxybate is a sodium load. When you take 6 grams of sodium oxybate, it's a little over a gram of salt. So you as a clinician have to weigh the cost-benefit ratio of this salt intake in an individual with hypertension or heart disease or renal disease. Certainly take that into account. We do know that patients with heart failure have comorbid sleep disordered breathing fairly commonly and maybe as high as 70%. However, we also know that sleep apnea occurs in narcolepsy patients. That's not necessarily a contraindication treatment. What we do is we make sure that the sleep disorder breathing is being treated with CPAP or whatever treatment we think is appropriate, and then initiate the sodium oxybate therapy. So it's not a contraindication. Is there data on positive impact of exercise in these patients? I don't think there's any data on that. I mean, there's a little bit of data on sleep and its effect on exercise in sports medicine arena, but nothing that I know of in the narcolepsy patient. We do occasionally see some weight loss in folks on sodium oxybate. It's unclear why. And, the patients report to us from a clinical global impression they're not napping as much, they're more active. But in terms of exercise, peak exercise performance, VO2 max, there's no data. How do you differentiate between hypersomnia, delayed sleep phase, or narcolepsy when overnight sleep study MSLT is borderline and patient has EDS, even when the sleep hygiene is optimal and all other etiologies have been explored? Well, the multiple sleep latency test, as you know, is a fragile test. It's not 100%. And depending on which data you look at, I mean, it's some old, some new. I usually use a rule of thumb, 5% of the narcolepsy MSLT patients have a normal MSLT, and 25% may have a non-diagnostic one. And there's even been some publications looking at individuals who have low hypercretin levels, known CSF low hypercretin levels, and there's a fairly high false negative rate. So as a clinician, you'd need to continue to correlate, make sure the individuals are getting adequate sleep. Maybe if you're not sure, get actigraphy to make sure they have adequate time in bed and opportunity to sleep and another estimate of total sleep time. And then, of course, repeat the MSLT to help you figure out, does this patient primarily have primary hypersomnia, circadian misalignment, or do they have narcolepsy? And then query about the other symptoms. I mean, I think the vivid dreams, sleep paralysis, hypnagogic, hypnopompic hallucinations, all those things are beneficial. So we're close to running out of time. I have a quick question. What quality measures do we have to monitor these patients? The quality measures, again, the clinical global impression. You ask about what effect does sleepiness have in those domains of social, work, driving, performance, and other activities. And then we use the Epworth score. And then quantify the cataplexy. How does a cataplexy, how frequently does it occur? Does it alter behavior? Because some patients are afraid to be in certain situations because they know they have the cataplexy and it may embarrass them. So it looks like I need to close this off. Let me see. One last question. Do you see benefit with sodium oxybate in narcolepsy type 2 patients? Certainly. Sodium oxybate is improved to treat excessive sleepiness by the FDA. So we certainly see that in individuals. The pivotal trial data showed a significant improvement in the Epworth score in these individuals. And again, there were studies looking at objective data, looking at the maintenance of wakefulness test that showed improvement in individuals who were actually on modafinil at the time as well. So with this, I will, from all of us at CME Outfitters, I'm Dr. Bogan, thanking you for joining us today. I hope you're able to incorporate the strategies we have discussed into improved care for your patients, and thank you very much for your attention.